Not why chromosome 2K compatible. In honor of bad moms, what's the funniest female performance of the pre-2000s?
I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with all three of the ladies from the first Wives Club. Goldie Hawn, Diane Keaton, and Bette Midler. Rocking it. 1996 style.
I'm Joanna Robinson. I'm going to give it to Sally Field, but probably also Whoopi Goldberg and other ladies in Soap Dish.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. The first thing that sprung to my mind was Madeline Kahn, and it's hard to choose between her Mel Brooks performances, so let's go with her as Miss White in Clue.
And I am David Ehrlich, and while I feel bad for going something with something so recent or right under the cutoff, I've been thinking a lot about Election recently. Why? It's hard to say. And I am going to go with Reese Witherspoon as the immortal Tracy Flick.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is Fighting in the War Room episode 129 for Tuesday, July 26, 2016. And on this date, in 1948, singer Bob Howard became one of the first black male hosts on television with, can anyone guess? That's right, the Bob Howard Show on CBS. No one does that anymore. You don't get your show anymore, do they?
You mean like because it's late night with James Corden or whatever and not like the James Corden show?
It's yeah, the no age of the brand coming first.
Well, didn't NBC apologize for canceling the Michael J. Fox show too soon because they were being all hasty this year? That was a show.
Oh, that was like sitcom. We're talking about like a...
Oh, like a variety
like a
show?
Like late night. Yeah, yeah, right?
That's a good point.
Well, there's Maya and Martin.
That's certainly close. Well, I hope someone can break through and get their own show again. Back in the good old days. Anywho, this is the part of the podcast where we talk about reviews, because unlike last week, people actually left some. We commanded them. Call to action. You left some reviews on iTunes. Now we're going to read them. David, you have one or two
celebrities. What do they know? Do they know things? Let's find out. First, we have JMKH427, who says, let's get a beer and talk movies. As the title suggests, I'd love to get a beer and talk movies with all of you. I'm so glad to have stumbled upon the podcast. I often find myself nodding at and talking back to my phone, mostly agreeing with David, in parentheses, whatever that says about me, close parentheses.
Seek help.
I really enjoy all of the opinions, whether I agree with them or not, and the discussions of sometimes random and quirky pop culture things. Thank you, JMKH427. We also have Dan Bala, who says, thanks for the shows. First, I want to thank the creators for the time to put it out. Thank you. Since you have asked for reviews, and since reviewing the reviewers only seems fair, here it goes. The best thing about the show is that it features a range of opinions, from fanboy-leaning Dave Seven to more mainstream Katie, art film-leaning David. The only downside is that often the more cynical takes are voiced the loudest. Welcome to America, buddy. David Eric... in particular, seems to have more fun tearing down movies he hates than praising movies he likes. It must not be an easy job to have to suffer through so many bad days at the movies. I appreciate your sympathy. Patches seems to have a particularly idiosyncratic view, and I am entertained trying to predict how he might come down on any given movie. Katie seems to represent the most mainstream, i.e. non-fanboy, take. So she is often the best predictor of how a movie will be judged by the general audience. Thanks again, guys. You are welcome. And finally...
Fanboy.
I created an iTunes account just to leave this review, says PG2K. I never leave reviews, but I felt compelled to leave a 5-star review because I love this podcast. In fact, I downloaded iTunes and reactivated my dead iTunes account for this review. It seemed important enough for me to go through the trouble of verification, emails, and new passwords so I could leave 5 stars and also say this. David Ehrlich is such a pretentious dick. I say that with all due respect and love for his work. He is like an expert surgeon, meticulously cutting out any art that he disapproves of like a cancer.
He's also a dick.
He delights in crushing any joy people like Dave Seven. And I feel witzed watching the latest Friday night popcorn flick. all the while chuckling at his oh-so-clever Fritz Lang reference. I get it. I hate ballet. I find it really boring and stupid. If I were on a ballet podcast, it'd be pretty hard for me to hold my tongue. That being said, I wouldn't want him to change, in parentheses, too much. I really, really love this podcast. It might be my favorite podcast of the week. The chemistry is great, and I really love how I never know how each member of the podcast will react to a movie or TV show. The podcast shines when members have opposite feelings and have a good discussion about it. You guys rule. I hope this came off as sarcastic ribbing and not internet bullying. P.S. Let Dave Seven and Katie talk. Well, the only person who's silencing Katie right now is her three-week-old child.
So, I have a dispatch from Katie Rich. Can I read it?
You may.
Yes.
Katie says hello to the podcast listeners, and she says, tell them the kid with no teeth was the clear breakout star of Stranger Things, and the second episode of The Night Of was a slog, but I'm sticking with it. And those are the entirety of my pop culture opinions. So that's the news from Katie Rich and Baby Lynn. She's
getting telegrams from war.
That's great.
The front lines.
The second episode of The Night Of was great. Fuck you, Katie.
Oh, fighting is back. All right.
It gets better the night of, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it ever got bad, so that's
there you opinion. Go. That's the right opinion. Well, thank you, everyone, for leaving reviews. I won't yell at anyone to go on iTunes and leave a 5-star review, which helps us gain traction on iTunes and find new listeners. We will not yell at you to do that. But as this person said, this is not the first time they're listening to it, but these reviews, if you've heard them, this is the first time you're listening, hey, you're probably going to love this show, I hope. But if it's not the first time you're listening to this podcast, go find someone who's never heard Fighting in the War Room and tell them to listen to this episode, because there were some really good reviews and people had thoughts. And David, you're not a dick. I just want to say
thanks. Oh, thanks.
But let's get to Fighting in the War
Room. Listeners, what do they know? Do they know things? We found out.
Ooh, baby, I like it raw. Yeah, baby, I like it raw. Ooh, baby, I like it raw. Yeah, baby, I like it raw. Shimmy, shimmy, y'all, shimmy, yam, shimmy, yeah. Give me the mic so I can take a
Well, I mean, my big caveat about talking about BoJack is that I've only seen one episode of the new season, but I did really, as someone who had always appreciated the show, that it existed. And like many things, like Hamilton, was a bit put off by the intensity of the love for it. I felt on the outside and didn't have the time or energy to join the inner fold. I finally, when the third season came out this weekend, I rewatched the second season, or watched the rest of the second season that I haven't seen. And what a delightful show this is. I wanted to kickstart a conversation hoping that my peers were better versed in it and had seen the new episodes. But I finally get it, I feel, at least, to the best of my ability.
What do you get about it? Because I feel like it's a very different type of animated sitcom, that, or at least that's why it's revered by critics. And yet in some ways, I think it's very, I don't know, kind of commonplace and derivative of a lot of other comedy that we've seen in recent years. So what do you love about BoJack?
I just think it's my thoughts are a little bit unformed. I kept thinking about Mad Men while watching it, because I think that BoJack is such a Don Draper-like character, with obviously coming from a different place and with a very different sensibility. But I do think in its own way that BoJack Horseman is yet another look at the psyche of the unlikable American male. You know, a very sort of skewed look at that, but it's also very, very funny. I mean, there's a lot. This is obviously created by somebody and by some buddies who grew up watching the golden ages of The Simpsons. I think that same streak of humor runs through it from the surface to
Its soul. Their sign game is on point.
Their sign game is unparalleled. It triumphs over even Futurama, which invented an entire different language for signs, literally. The sign game here is next level. There are, and not just signs. I mean, I'm talking about like any text or visual gag that can be tucked into a background. And the way that those visual gags become the substance of the show, like the running whatever animal that is. I want to say baboon, but I don't trust myself with my animals, that jogs by BoJack's house every morning and then ends up playing a surprisingly pivotal role in a certain season two episode. All of this stuff feels like it's a coherent world. I love how throwaway gags become, you know, fundamental pieces of the show. I mean, Hollywood being the most obvious example. The absurdity of it is terrific. J.D. Salinger running my favorite recurring gag of the show, which is now a reference for the third time in this episode already. Celebrities, what do they know? Do they know things? Let's find out. And then, of course, its tragic end when J.D. Salinger told the story he wanted to tell by asking celebrities. They found out what they knew. Did they know things? We found out. So good. I mean, the episodes are brilliantly crafted. This is what you get when you do a show like this and you only have to churn out 11 or 12 or whatever it is rather than 22 per year. I think there's real
really,
heart.
Who has to do that anymore? Come on.
No, I know. No, but no you see it less with this kind of show. This kind of show, even now, is still produced at sort of breakneck speed. The density of what's happening in these stories, how they all pay off, the pathos getting – how it sort of comes into it organically. It doesn't really feel like, you know, the way that like Standalone Complex does, which is to throw a left field reference to Ghost of the Shell, where it's like one episode is about the overall mythology and one is a throwaway. Yes, BoJack does that, but everything can trip. Like when they do, let's say, the penultimate episode of season two, which goes in a really dramatic direction – albeit still a funny one, it doesn't feel like it is just a topping or it's just been lathered on. It does feel like there are strong roots there that have been planted as a portrait of dissatisfaction, of failure, of self-worth. I think it's uncannily accurate. The cast is incredible. There's never been a more fun show to play Guess That Name, or Guess That Voice, rather.
You love BoJack.
I love BoJack, I hear very promising things about season three, so I look forward to figuring out what they are. The first episode was great.
It's definitely in line with what you're describing when you're talking about episodes that kind of go really, really hard on the joke and try and weave in story as well. There's the second episode of the third season. It takes place in 2007 and does like a backstory episode, but every beat has a reference to some
yes,
pop culture thing.
I did see a little bit of that one as well,
and it is
amazing.
Like Jorge Garcia playing what his character from Lost or whatever. Or no, actually, he's playing Jorge Garcia. BoJack cuts him off mid-Lost conversation. I mean, it's just very relentless. That's part of the joy of BoJack, but it's also part of the risk it takes, and I think sometimes for me, it kind of fails in that regard. Or like the fourth episode of the third season takes place entirely underwater, and he goes to an underwater movie festival with some fish, and he wears a helmet, and there's basically no dialogue because he can't speak fish and he can't speak outside of his breathing apparatus. I felt like I was drowning the whole time. I almost had a panic attack.
I do like
insane.
The density of the humor, because I feel like I watch movies in particular, and also, you know, half-hour TV shows, where it feels like there's so much wasted time. And I think the Netflix model encourages rewatching because it's right there at your fingertips. And I think that BoJack, especially for the kind of humor that it is, and knowing, you know, created by people who obsessed over Simpsons gags and would know every line of an episode, it's really wired for them. It's geared so that you can there's always something to sort of see and rediscover. And repetition breeds greater hilarity. And that's one of the things that I enjoy about it in this
Apparently
form.
Apparently every episode is exactly the same length. The creator.
Yes.
What's his name? Bob Waxberg? Or that's his last name. Anyway, they're all 25 minutes and 30 seconds. And for some reason, they have to be that every single time.
It's Raphael Bob Waxberg.
Yes, what a name. So Joanna, you were going to chime in here about BoJack. Maybe BoJack is not the best show ever.
No, well, I'm just going to admit bias. I had a come to Jesus moment at Comic-Con this weekend. We're going to talk about Comic-Con a little later on, watching the Lego Batman panel, which is that I just cannot tolerate.
It's Will Arnett.
Will Arnett, yeah. In any form. And like, I understand that his career is built upon making fun of this sort of toxic American male masculinity. Like, he did it in Arrested Development. He's doing it in Lego Batman, like big time in Lego Batman. He does it in BoJack. And I watch a lot of episodes of BoJack Horseman, trying really hard to like it and feeling frustrated that I couldn't get into it. And then just watching Will Arnett at Comic-Con, I was like, oh, this is
what can I tell you?
I don't think that's biased.
I think I like BoJack so much because I can't stand Will Arnett. I think that that was my greatest obstacle to enjoying the show. It's been my greatest obstacle to really giving a shit about Arrested Development. But I think what he does with this character here plays to his weaknesses and makes them all strengths. And it really, I think exactly what you were saying about the kind of character that he does, I think all of those things really, because the character, it's so self-loathing. I mean, it's so, takes that character to task that it's not trying to have its cake and eat it too, which I think was the problem with his shtick so many other places. I think it works here.
I will say that I love Paul F. Tompkins on the BoJack Horseman episodes that I've watched.
It's Mr. Peanut Butter, the
Mr.
dog.
Peanut Butter, yeah. His Mr. Peanut Butter. See, that's like Paul F. Tompkins doing, because he's also doing like a kind of toxic masculinity, like ripping apart comedy. But Paul F. Tompkins in real life is so the opposite of that that I'm not making any casting aspersions on Will Arnett as a human being because I do not know him personally. I'll just say that, like, because I've only ever seen him play like basically this character, I'm just kind of tired of it.
Well, so, part of it too. Yeah. I mean, what stands in the way of BoJack being great for me, I think, is the Hollywood satire aspect, which I know is not necessarily the driving force. You know, BoJack could be in any place and still be having this, these neurotic episodes, this depression, just being on the wrong path. But there's something about the inside baseball aspect of it that seems to just interfere with the pathos that, David, you were describing. I'm thinking of, there's an entire episode, I can't remember if it was season one or season two, where they're just like ripping hard into the improv scene.
It is, saying, in season two.
Just because I've done improv theater in the past. I took it personally. No, I did not take it personally. Improv is, you should all see Mike Birbiglia's new movie, Don't Think Twice.
Don't Think Twice.
Talk about ripping.
Don't so look good. Back.
Improv in a cathartic way. It's fine. I mean, I would recommend it.
Let's so great. Yeah. Loved it,
but
David.
This was just not productive analysis Joanna. Of Hollywood. I find the whole secretariat plot to be kind of silly. Just, it's all inside baseball stuff. But the best part about the show is when BoJack leaves Hollywood and goes on his spirit journey and, you know, has these run-ins with his past, what you were describing in the penultimate episode of season two, and just gets disgusting, and the show takes this really daring move. Like, the bad thing we think he's going to do is the second worst thing he could do, and he decides to do the first worst thing. And it's just so disgusting, and that's when I really like the show. But Hollywood, I guess to kind of wrap up here, is this, I don't know, does that work for you too? The Hollywood aspect of this show, that it's set in the industry that is creating it?
I think so.
We need more of this.
I mean, I do really want to hear from Dave. I just wanted to, one last, to button up what Joanna was saying, that three seasons in, every time Diane refers to her now husband as Mr. Peanut Butter, I laugh out loud. Dave, what do you know? What do you think?
I watched BoJack Horseman once somebody convinced me that season one sort of like came together. Might have been you, David. I don't remember. Someone was like, hey, this is like a good thing, because I didn't like I guess I share everybody's concern about it being too Hollywood and about committing to jokes that don't like necessarily resolve within the episode. Sometimes it felt like in the early episodes of BoJack Horseman that everybody was, you know, sort of on a different wavelength than I was as a viewer. But then once I fell into it, I liked it. And then I started season two, and about halfway through it, like, started wearing on me for the Hollywood stuff that Patches is talking about, and I kind of gave up. And then I watched one episode of Flaked, and I was like, Whoa. Oh shit, Will Arnett could be so much more specific about making fun of Los Angeles, and then I was able to go back and finish BoJack Horseman season 2. So it's like,
I know Flaked got you through tough times.
I know I'm always talking about Fringe, but like Anna Torv in Fringe, I was playing this character that I didn't like for the first season, and then as soon as the second season it expanded and she got to play multiple versions of that character, I realized that she was just portraying a character that was very cold, and I didn't like how that character presented herself, but it wasn't the actress. So it's like seeing Will Arnett's scope of some sort of thing, I realized I could overshoot, and I was able to come back to BoJack Horseman, and I think sort of appreciate it. But it is something, because it's a Netflix animated show, I think it's better if you just watch all of it in one chunk, because if there's some hard-going episodes, like quitting, I think is really detrimental to how the whole thing gels.
I will say that my publication finds its way into like a lot of different shows because people like to mock us. But my favorite joke ever has to be Manity Fair.
Well, have you gotten have you gotten to the point where Manity Fair plays a really large role in the plot? Okay.
Yes. But Manity Fair as a pun at all is just something I have to appreciate. So
yes.
Can I ask one final question here? What do you make of Todd, Aaron Paul's character in this show? That's what never quite clicks for me, and he's always around.
I think he gets better really weird as he goes on. I mean, you realize that he is a parody of so You're the Worst, I think. I can't watch You're the Worst because I hate the roommate character so much, the Todd of that show.
I hate him.
And I ruined the show. I quit that show, and I'm never going back. And Todd is a mockery of that character. He is the joke. But the beauty of him is that BoJack can't stand him, and that he's like this asexual. He's completely asexual. His plots always, I think, enhance BoJack rather than feel like traditional B plots, which is important to me. The first episode of season 3, there is an all time great subplot about him getting lost in the way that people always do in shows when they go to New York for the first time, but he's just in the hotel hallway of BoJack's hotel, and they have
You've seen a lot more of
season 3. No, this is the first episode.
Really?
Yeah. I think that whole plot and how it's resolved and how it just sort of emotionally dovetails with what's happening with BoJack speaks to why Todd is so pivotal to this show.
Well, I was just going to say it's funny that you brought up You're the Worst, because I was going to mention that last summer when BoJack season 2 was airing, and everyone was like, this is the most striking depiction of depression in a show ever. And I think especially given that it's like a comedy animated series the context of it makes an examination of depression all the more interesting. But it was airing right around the same time as You're the Worst season 2, which I think was the most striking depiction of depression on television. So
yeah, my depression, having to watch some of those episodes. Am I right?
So if
I'm with David on this one.
So if you're gonna watch one show about depression on television, watch You're the Worst, not BoJack.
Oh God,
that's how Joanna ends the BoJack segment.
No, this segment ends with Amy Sedaris is great.
Amy Sedaris is queen. Yes, queen.
And now we've ended on appropriation of something.
Marvel check seems to keep getting lost in the mail, so I have to side hustle where I can, and fortunately Amazon has come a courting, and I have been in the tank for this movie, and Amazon's got that new media money, so it's all good. I've been in the tank.
The Shamus-verse returns.
I think Indignation's Amazon. Did I make that up? No, that sounds right. It's gotta be. It's not important. Nope. What's
Someone
important?
Is putting
Someone's
out this
paying
movie.
David.
My silly framing device is irrelevant. What matters here is that Indignation is a film that I want to stump for a little bit, just for a minute or two. It is counter-programming in the truest sense to everything else you're going to see this summer. It is an adaptation of a Philip Roth novel. Not the last one we'll get this year, mind you, but because Ewan McGregor is making his directorial debut with American Pastoral How? If you've read that novel, I do not know. But
what do you mean, how? Why do you say how?
I mean, Roth is traditionally very, famously very, very difficult to adapt.
Sure.
American Pastoral is about as hard as it gets from where I'm standing. I do not know how anyone, let alone a first-time director, is going to do it. I am bracing for disaster.
Start off with a bang. Go from there.
Sure. Anyway, Indignation is James Shamus's first film as director. That name may be familiar to you because James Shamus was the CEO of Focus Features for 13 years. He was instrumental in the release of films you love, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which he co-wrote with Ang Lee, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Lost in Translation, Atonement. And Atonement is the perfect segue for this because Indignation is essentially the Jewish Atonement. And don't Ooh. Click away quite yet.
No, you got me. Yeah, you hooked me.
It is it is very, 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 very similar in tone and plot, in setting, even though it takes place in New Jersey. Eventually in Ohio. Starts in New Jersey. In 1951, Logan Lerman plays the nicest Jewish boy in the world, Marcus Mesner. He's obsessed with not getting killed in Korea, as are his parents. He goes to college, where he's one of the only Jews on campus. He falls in love with a girl, one of his fellow students named Olivia Hutton, who's played by the great Sarah Gadon. I don't think this is a spoiler, but let's just say that she gives him the most eventful blowjob in film history, and the rest of the movie spirals out from there. It is, and if you think to Wait, Atonement...
Is she Jewish? Or is
no,
she
he is Jewish. Shiksa. She is a Shiksa. If you think to Atonement and
super Shiksa.
How a sex act in that film spiraled sort of out of control, the particulars, the end result, everything is different in Indignation, but the general tone, all the way down to the music here, which is written by a young composer named Jay Wadley, which is this very sort of searing string-based score. It's quite lovely. I think this film is brilliant. It's at one time a very, very literal adaptation of Philip Roth's novel, but at the other hand, to mix my metaphors, an aggressive adaptation, particularly with these two framing devices that it uses. And framing devices tend to be disastrous when applied and invented for adaptations, but here I think they do a really brilliant job of compounding the narrative devices and strengthening some of the movie's key themes. It's a hell of a directorial debut from a guy who's been making incredibly important movies for a long time. Movie. Yeah, but he learned a lot. And my first takeaway from this movie is that he's still making Focus Features. When you talk about the studio as auteur, yeah, he had a lot of filmmakers working under him. And yes, he co-wrote a lot of Focus's movies. Or not a lot, but the Ang Lee ones that really, Brokeback Mountain, etc. But his sensibilities clearly were palpable in the movies that they were making there, and they continue to shine through here. It opens in limited release, at least, on Friday the 29th. And if any of what I just said sounds interesting to you, you should see it. And if not, then the scene in which there's a 15-minute scene in the middle of the movie in which Logan Lerman squares off with Tracy Letts, who's playing the dean of the college, that in and of itself is worth the price of admission.
Tracy Letts is a genius. It looks like it's wide released August 5th. So I'm sold. I'll be there.
Great.
I say that as speaking for the people who live in the boonies. August 5th is the date.
And if you're Jewish, you must go see this movie. It is your duty.
I really wanted this segment to end with
duty
saying some sort of Hebrew.
Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu Melech Olam, Indignation.
For our final segment of the evening, we are all here to talk about an event that 20 minutes before I got on this call, I just walked in my door from, which is Comic-Con 2016 San Diego, David Ehrlich's favorite movie TV-based event of the year.
Comic-Con!
Comic books. Woo!
Show me your trailers!
I was there, but rest assured that like Patches and Dave following from home probably absorbed more than I did because it's hard to like absorb it all when you're in it. I guess I will start by saying what my favorite thing that came out of like my favorite tangible thing we can all watch that came out of Comic-Con was the trailer for Legion, the new FX series from Noah Hawley, based on it, which is an X-Men property.
You are biased.
I am so biased. I am biased. It looks so incredible. It stars Dan Stevens of The Guest in Downton Abbey fame and Aubrey Plaza and a bunch of Fargo people. And it just looks really stylish and just a really, really interesting take
He's
on
technically
comic
in,
book television.
It technically takes place in the X-Men universe. Am I correct?
Yeah. Didn't I say an X-Men property?
Oh, you did.
He's
sorry.
Like Dan Stevens' character is Professor X's son. So it does take place.
Wow.
And it looks better than any Bryan Singer property ever has, in my opinion. So
it looks a lot like okay. Mr. Robot with some sort of what is his power?
How
exactly?
dare you?
Sorry.
Okay, so the deal
cinematographically with Legion, speaking.
The deal with Legion is that he correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, he's schizophrenic or has multiple personality disorder. And each one of his personalities has a different mutant ability. But the way that Noah Hawley is pitching this series, I interviewed him a couple months ago, and the way he's pitching the series is he wants to make it more ambiguous. Like, does he actually have superpowers?
Ugh.
Or is he just crazy? Shut up. It's going to be great. I'm so excited.
It sounds truly awful in the worst of Mr. Robot like ways.
Yes.
I cannot wait for you to eat your words and say
Listen, I am only basing this off your words because I have not seen anything about this. And I love Noah Hawley because Fargo is phenomenal.
I don't really love Mr. Robot, so trust me, if it had like a strong whiff of Mr. Robot, I would not be for it. Patches, what's the best thing you saw come out of Comic-Con?
Well, I think the magic of Comic-Con is how a perfectly organized panel and the right trailer at the right moment can just leave you drunk. And I think I'm drunk on Wonder Woman. And the DC universe. Once again, I'm drunk on DC movies. Look, Batman v Superman was fucking horrible. I hated it, and I still do. And the extended edition is sitting right in front of me. I will bring myself to watch it maybe one day, or at least the extra bits. But I had such an unpleasant time at that movie, left burned. And DC, I prefer DC comics over Marvel comics. Obviously, I'm a Green Lantern defender. People who listen to this show know this. But I just felt so burned by Batman v Superman. And I actually thought that the Justice League footage that they showed was a big, like, overstep in terms of course correction for that movie universe. Oh, we're all going to make jokes.
I want to give the Justice League clip a little bit of, I don't know, an excuse, because I know they've only been shooting for a little while. That said, I, aside from the return to whatever the Oz movie with Lea Michele as the voice of Dorothy that I saw at the last Comic-Con I was at, the trailer for that, it was the single worst thing I've ever seen come out of Comic-Con. I mean, truly astoundingly bad.
That is outrageous.
Bad.
That's preposterous.
It's awful to infinity, and they should fire everyone and start over. The Wonder Woman trailer looked phenomenal.
Right, yeah, so it's such a big leap. I mean, Justice League, you're right, they've only been shooting for a little while, and it's totally cobbled together.
Every single moment was worse than the one before it. It was
the humor
agony.
Just does not play for me at all. It's like, you're not Guardians of the Galaxy. You don't have to be, actually. Or you're not even Suicide Squad. Who knows what that movie's actually going to be, since they reshot half of it to make it more fun or jokier. But they're clearly going for that same vibe and trying to change Ben Affleck's Batman into... What was that?
Reaction noises.
What?
It was reaction noises.
I couldn't tell what the
I
fuck
was
going on.
Sorry, I was doing my Jared Leto Joker.
through the tronning on Skype, I couldn't. It sounded like you were getting sucked into the digisphere.
It's my really good Jared Leto as the Joker.
It
impression.
Was so good, man. Why did you send me a dead hog and a dead bird and a dead rat? The one thing I wanted to say about Justice League was that I actually liked Ben Affleck's Batman in that movie. I kind of dug his brooding detective, and I wanted more of the detective stuff. And here, now he's like part brooding, kind of sarcastic and jokey, getting the gang back together. It definitely doesn't have the rhythm of like Ocean's 11, which it probably should if you're going to go get the gang. And I don't know. I don't know what to make of this movie, but I know they're going to be fighting a big fucking monster at the end, just like Batman v Superman. So I'm not sure what the hell is going to happen with that one, but The Wonder Woman footage.
That was just, that's what was interesting to me about the Suicide Squad trailer. Is I feel like for the first time we saw that they too will be fighting like a big CGI like storm cloud monster, right? Like that's the first time we saw like the big like confrontation.
Oh, I still haven't seen that one because I figured we're so close. I should stop watching trailers for that. So I haven't seen anything beyond snippets of the like, mysterious villain. I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah, they show like this big, you know, showdown like that looks a lot like Batman v Superman.
What is with cloud villains? I thought we learned from Fantastic or Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, that cloud villains are bad. This is why I don't like Star Trek Beyond very much.
That's that's the only good cloud villain there has been, because he wasn't he was more of you know, the actual villain in the course of the story was sort of his emissary. And he was just ominous, horrifying imagery, which really left an impression in my head. And he wasn't just terrible
in
CG. That
Rise of the Silver Surfer?
Yeah. Galactus, just that fucking thing.
Wait.
Like, eating Earth?
You're putting Galactus as, like, best cloud villain ever?
Yeah.
This is unbelievable.
Okay, there's like, okay, first of all, Tim Curry, sexist in Ferngully, definitely out there.
I'm thinking in terms of the superhero movies that we are dealing with.
After this podcast over, Dave, I'm going to call you to write this list.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs?
Oh, my God. As I said during Comic-Con, I think
Rhino from James and the Giant Peach.
The reason that it is that the fact that DC has not gotten their shit together is why I am more excited for their movies than I am for Marvel's. It is why I think the ceiling is higher for what they can accomplish, because Marvel has found their groove, and I think it's been the greatest detriment of those movies is that they always play it safe. They are very predictable. The risk factor forces them to jump and take chances. They're still trying to figure out what works. And when they lock into something, it could be something better than what we're used to. And at least maybe best case scenario, not holding my breath, we'll get a handful of movies that feel genuinely bold within that arena.
The Wonder Woman trailer gives a lot of hope. Yeah.
Here's what was interesting to me about the DC panel is like they started the whole panel in an unusual way, which is they trotted out their directors for their upcoming films as like a sense of we are giving these creators actual you know, autonomy over their projects, which is bullshit probably, also to show their diversity, right? Because it's you know, Patty Jenkins and Zack Snyder, Ben Affleck, Rick Famuyiwa, James Wan, and like you know, to like bring out their panel and then to have Zack Snyder talk about how proud he was about this fraternity of directors, and then he was like I guess a sorority too. I was just like, yeah, all right, DC. I mean, the whole DC culture, there's a toxicity to it that I don't know how we come out of, and we'll see.
Really? It's these voices you're describing. I mean, Zack Snyder feels like he's on the outs. This is the end for
voices
him.
Like, but the voice of Ben Affleck, like, oh, I cannot wait. Like,
no, not the voice of Ben Affleck. Well, okay.
Anyway, I think it bodes well for the movies to have, I mean, I could not agree more with Joanna that it's probably a show.
It's a show.
Of course it's a show. It's Comic-Con, and we live in a culture where people judge the marketing more strenuously than they do the product, which is vile. But I don't know if that's true.
I think Batman v Superman stands up against that criticism.
Well, they certainly judge the marketing for a lot longer than they judge the movies. It is definitely a very good look when you're trying to impress upon people the quality of what you're making, to trot out the directors and say, these are the creators, and, you know, then we'll introduce the movies one by one. I think it was a good
thing. But it also helps.
Does it matter in the long run? No.
I know that Dave and I, I want to say one more quick thing about the WPB panel, which was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my entire life, which is Charlie Hunnam by himself on that enormous stage, flogging for the ridiculous Guy Ritchie King Arthur movie that looks like, if you want to talk about the biggest piece of trash to ever come out of Comic-Con, watch that trailer and then get back to me.
I have heard some very bad things about that movie in terms of just, I mean, the final product might be good, but I've definitely
heard. The concept alone is terrible. The broification of the Knights of the Round Table, like after what he did to Sherlock. Okay. But what I really want, I know, so Dave and I are going to talk about more.
Show
about
me on the doll where he touched Sherlock.
I will. Okay, never mind. This is for a different time. Dave and I are going to talk more about this in Star Wars Spoilers about Comic-Con in general, but I am curious, Dave, what your favorite thing to come out of Comic-Con was.
My favorite thing to come out of Comic-Con was from the Adult Swim on the Green Rick and Morty live panel, where they had an animatic of Justin Roiland doing that Georgia like legal case that came on the internet and went viral last month.
It was a murder trial where the criminal was like, fuck you, to the judge, and the judge was pushing back against him.
Yeah, and it goes on for like 10 minutes. They did it with Morty as the judge and Rick as the defendant, and it's like the transcript was written for those characters, and I think it's on YouTube now, and it's definitely my favorite thing to come out of Comic-Con.
This is weird. This is weird for you, because this is like an actual piece of filmmaking. This is actual performance. This is not marketing. This is not looking ahead. This is not news. This is just something that you can watch right now.
Well, I've been in this game striking. Long enough that I've been saying Planet Hulk for like 6 years, so when that happens, I'm just going to be like, well, guess I have to stop saying that now because it's actually happening. So I can't say that there was a lot of surprises. Like, my surprises were more like, oh, King Kong's that big? Like, I knew he was going to be bigger than normal, but I didn't know he was going to be, like, that big. That's cool.
Are they sizing him up so that he can fight Godzilla?
Yes. That's why. Uh-huh.
I have serious reservations about Jordan Vogt Roberts' ability to deliver a movie, a King Kong movie of any quality. But the shot of the dragonfly, or the helicopter sort of becoming the dragonfly, whatever it was. Okay, all the Comic-Con footage is blending it together. You know what I'm talking about if you've seen the trailer.
Yeah, yeah. Where it points out the dragonflies and helicopters.
Yeah, I was like, that's as pure a moment of visual delight as any of these movies have been able to deliver.
Well, and that's what you got to go for with these kaiju monkey movies. It's like, I can't imagine a plot that I would care about that I haven't seen with King Kong 1,000 times before. So just have him like destroy everything in like a quick 90 minutes, and let's just do this.
Have him destroy everything. Just destroy everything.
Yeah,
I was just mesmerized by Jordan Vogt Roberts' like massive beard at Comic-Con that I forgot to like Google him, and now I'm seeing that he's another one of those Sundance film director darlings that got a major blockbuster. He did The Kings of Summer, basically went directly from that to Kong Skull Island. I somehow missed that whole thing, which is my least favorite Hollywood trend.
I have been on very good authority that some very veteran actors, and they, you know, who knows how this bears out in the final quality. The movie could be as much of a pleasant surprise for me as Godzilla was, which would be wonderful because we all know how much I love that movie. And the themes that were espoused in this footage definitely harken back to Gareth Edwards' Godzilla when they talk about, you know, men. It's obviously a parallel for the Vietnam War, but they're talking about how men are not, you know, this is not their planet and so on.
I just hope that if they've made the gorilla
Patches, I have heard that very veteran actors at this movie have been very displeased with his direction.
Wow.
Not the quality of it, but the means by which he gives direction.
Serious hearsay
I will say this, between Tarzan and Kong Skull Island, I'm okay if we press pause on like Samuel Jackson sort of reading lines over a trailer for a little while. Hey, like he can be in a movie and not be the trailer narrator. I think it's okay. So
I don't know. He's got the voice.
Yeah, no. I think the Miss Peregrine's trailer would be better if his voice was the one telling me what was going on.
It would. It definitely would. You're right. Anything else Comic-Con wise you want to talk about?
Well,
anything
David,
that like
David
I as an eyewitness on the ground can bring to this conversation?
Well,
oh yeah,
my
David,
my favorite
what was your favorite
thing?
Thing?
Was, not being there. And my second favorite thing was Blair Witch. This was a secret that that the blogosphere has been keeping for a long time. I think we were all well aware of this movie being.
I was not.
You're out of the blogosphere.
Sorry. I guess I'm sorry. I'm
it was
not
hard.
In the
I mean, because it was kept so secret, it was hard to know the degree of secrecy with which to keep it. You know, like people would tell it to you like it was a state secret, and you were like, "Oh, I'm going to honor that and not." But it does turn out that everyone, or a lot of people,
I thought
it,
they were going to make it to the end. I really
well, that was the idea
that
was that like
market the
they,
movie that way.
They could have, but I think that obviously that wasn't the plan because they saw the success of 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I think that that is going to become the new standard for this sort of thing, and I hope we get more of it, at least based on the strength of that movie and the supposed quality of The Woods, which I've been hearing good things about since it screened that, you know, advanced guard of press many months ago, is that, you know, they have these Trojan horse sequels and they announce them roughly 2 months before they come out because it's like, surprise, it's done, it's already in the can. And they took it one step further than Cloverfield Lane in reviving this old, you know, in this age where brand is really king by, you know, really just taking the title and the mythos more than anything else, by releasing a trailer for the movie under a different name, not just shooting it and announcing it under a different name, but releasing a trailer for it and then swapping in the new one. And I was waiting to see how they're going to do it. And yeah, because it seemed untenable that they would keep a secret until September, and then just like the first audiences would go or critics would go.
It would have been amazing.
It would have been silly, too. And the message wouldn't have really. I think, you know, the way that they did it was
silly?
Smart. Yeah, because you would have had like critics tap dancing around it and not really being able to say anything substantial. Then those first screenings, people would have
been
like,
"That's what they do
at
everything."
No, I think this was a very, very smart way to do it. They had an Entertainment Weekly in-depth profile written already that they could just drop that answered all your questions.
Yeah. Content strategy, business rollout.
What the fuck do you think Comic-Con is about, Patches?
I'm not talking about Comic-Con. I'm talking about the excitement. I would have loved to have been in that screening and seen it, not knowing anything at first.
That would have been cool.
And I had hoped that people would have gotten to see
that way. But you know what would have happened? The film critics would have gone into a screening.
Wow.
I say this derisively
from the boonies. You really used
the
phrase film critic and laid into it there.
No, but I'm just saying, like, what if you if you're a studio and you put a secret in your film, the blogosphere, the film critics, and like, I'm not a film critic, but like, I love film critics, but like, they don't keep those secrets. They don't.
Well, we've done a really good job. Like, I mean, there are dozens of film critics who.
No, I'm not talking about this reveal. I'm saying if you, what Patches said, which is like, he wished he had been in the theater and had the theater experience of like, oh my God, this is a Blair Witch movie. What the fuck? But like, there's no way that film reviewers would have kept that, like people who got advanced screening of the movie would not have kept that secret from the film going on.
Here's the
it's like, you know, they're included in the moment and they want to be involved in perpetuating it. It's like, I don't know why this was my first thought, but it's like when Paul Thomas Anderson shot a Radiohead video at some lady's house and she's like, I don't even know what the fuck Radiohead is, but everyone needs to know about this.
Wait, I mean, you guys are all, it's all backwards because this is a sequel. Like, the reason it's better that they did it the way they did now so that everybody goes to see this Blair Witch sequel is ideally the movie isn't dependent on it. It's not like 10 Cloverfield Lane, you know, was a huge bait and switch. It still did something, you know, cool at the end of it, but it wasn't the giant monster we were all expecting. So we have, you know, the bait is the Blair Witch, but like you wouldn't want to like figure that out halfway through the movie because that's part of the lure.
No,
we're gonna go see a movie called
The Blair Witch is so identifiable.
I will never forget ever in my life one of the best movie going experiences, and this is just pure nerdery, is seeing the early working print screening of Hugo at the New York Film Festival.
Yes.
And not having any idea what it was about. And 30 minutes in I'm like, oh wait, is Ben Kingsley playing Georges Méliès? And then realizing that this was a 3D movie about Georges Méliès in the still and what will for always probably be the best use of 3D in motion picture. I mean, I was weeping in the theater. And that is very cool.
I really want to go back. I really want to go back to my point, which is like, I just want to speak again on behalf of the people, like, hashtag not all film critics. And I'm not really like throwing stones at any of the people on this podcast, but I just want to say for the average moviegoer, they don't get that experience, that like sense of wonderment and discovery that you get in an advanced screening, because even if critics are embargoed, that stuff gets out, like everything
actually in the bubble, because most people don't know anything. Like if they just had The Woods, they'd probably go see it on a Friday night. They're not reading about all this stuff.
It's in a larger bubble. It's like there's
bubble within
the,
a bubble.
The smaller
the inception bubble.
There's a smaller bubble of the film critics who like see the advanced screening and all share like their joy, and they get on Twitter and they do like half spoilers and like whatever.
Oh.
And then there's the larger, they do. Come on, like you can admit that without like feeling attacked
yourself.
Yeah,
but the five people who follow
there
all
are
of those schmoes
who have the privilege.
No, and then those people actually take their unknowing friends to these movies, and that's where the excitement happens. Everyone saw The Blair Witch Project. It was a phenomenon. You could do this movie and have it be a surprise without needing
that's
to broadcast
different,
it.
But that's this is such a different time than when The Blair Witch Project
I,
was
I don't know if I
I'm not
understand.
Even I'm not arguing I'm not arguing
no,
this
but I think I agree with Joanna.
I'm not arguing this as a way of this movie
that's
being
right.
successful financially. Obviously they're calling it Blair Witch so it makes money. I'm just saying you could preserve the secret if they wanted
but I do
to,
think
and
that
it would
this is
and I say you could not
everything
you
I've
know.
Seen about
I
this
say
movie
someone would see an advanced
and everything
screener
anyone
and
said to
out.
Me makes it sound like it's the one way it's very different than 10 Cloverfield Lane is that it's not just borrowing the name. This is a true direct sequel to the Blair Witch Project.
Well, in the trailer they're talking about finding the tapes and going looking for his sister, right?
Yes, but I have been told that like
connection.
you yes, and you like learn what happens after
you ain't
that
seen nothing
last
yet.
Shot at the from the original movie, which is a risky proposition, but and so on. So you know, this is a different. It's a different beast. It's a different time. And I thought that this was my favorite thing at Comic-Con, and it was unfurled as intelligently as I can think to do it.
The last thing I'll say to prove my point, which I think David will also agree with, is that we've all talked before about the joy of going to film festivals and watching movies that you know absolutely nothing beyond like a bare bones description and who's in it. And you haven't been inundated with the marketing for it or any of the advanced buzz. You just go in fresh and you experience it. That's a movie watching point of privilege that a lot of people don't have. But there is that sense of like going into something so fresh. And as much as I'm not the average moviegoer either. Like I listen to so many podcasts and follow certain people on Twitter. But as much as I try to preserve, you know, innocence going to certain movies. I mean, like, you know, this is a bad example, but Patch is trying to go into Star Wars fresh. Like, that's a bad example because that advertisement is anywhere. But to a lesser degree, that's true of every film and every TV that other people have.
I think the secret
access.
Is that a lot of people in this business got into this business because they needed to have that privilege. And they would go stir crazy if they didn't. So I think that there's a lot of validity in what Joanna's saying.
There's a flavor of lording it over people who haven't seen it yet. Like, I've seen this, you haven't
clearly
seen it
you're
yet.
Following
and,
the, wrong
and
people.
Like, that's
you
the,
should unfollow them.
That's the worst interpretation. The best interpretation is, I'm so excited to talk about all of this with you guys. I can't wait until you see it, too. But I just think the excitement gets the best of certain people, and they tend to leak things out. As someone who like hosts a podcast called Storm of Spoilers, I'm obviously not like super rigid about spoilers in general. I'm just saying that the whole advanced screening process makes it tricky from the point of view of a studio to put something truly surprising in a film and give people the experience of sitting their butt in a seat and seeing
that
something.
Is madness.
Anyway,
madness.
That's all.
God, you.
Well, I mean, Joss Whedon did something similar. And well, this is to the larger point of why I market it as a Blair Witch movie. Joss Whedon says something very similar in his Hall H panel that he does every year where he just like holds forth, like doesn't necessarily have anything to talk about except, you know, the status of the world. And he talked about how people don't see movies anymore unless they know everything about it first. And how he thinks that that's to
although
the detriment
horror
of original
movies
storytelling.
Are actually the outlier of that thinking. Lights Out did very well this weekend. These little horror movies do really well. You could put out The Woods in the middle of September when nothing's happening, and probably sell it just on being like a crazy found footage movie.
You could.
I don't know. But and then the word of mouth would build.
That version of something I would see on VOD, I will go see a Blair Witch movie in theaters. I think that's like, and I'm somebody who goes to like horror film festivals, so I'm like one foot in, one foot out. By the way, The Invitation is on Netflix now if you want to go back and listen to our episode about that being good.
To wrap up Comic-Con, I will say, Joanna, were you in the Star Trek panel?
Yeah, the one with Bakula and Shatner and all
Brian
that.
Fuller.
Yeah.
What did you...
Yeah, Shatner, Jerry Ryan...
It's pronounced Dracula.
Yeah, Scott Dracula, Jerry Ryan, Michael Dorn, Brent Spiner, William Shatner, and Brian Fuller. It was incredible. It was a lovely panel because even though Brian Fuller is, to a certain degree, selling his upcoming CBS show, it felt like a panel that wasn't about selling something. It was celebrating.
You know, it was selling something in a huge way, and I'm sold. I thought, yes. We can actually listen if people want to listen to this panel, our colleague Jordan Hoffman, who runs Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, was allowed to put the whole audio of it out. So if you download that episode, you can listen. And the panel is super awkward. I don't know how it felt in the room because the audio mixing on his recording is like no audience unless they're going mad or you can't hear them at all. And Brian Fuller, instead of asking questions that are like, William Shatner, what was it like on the first day of set? Or like, Jerry Ryan, what was it like to play the first nice Borg? He's like, you know, what do you think about race in America and identity? And how does that play into your
character?
I thought it was great.
Hold on. I'm not complaining. This is not a complaint. This is awesome. This was awesome. But here's the problem. No one on the panel was ready to answer these questions or entertain notions of parallels in the real world and their Star Trek characters. Brent Spiner is a total asshole. All of these guys, I mean, Michael Dorn is an amazing presence and he gave the most thoughtful answers. Shatner has some wackadoo politics that I don't know what's going on in his life, but
he's the best on Twitter. Talk to him, but he's fun to look at.
But unfortunately, the panelists I thought were kind of junk, but Brian Fuller, my God.
Brian Fuller
beaming
was the best.
Energy.
Yeah.
I think that Star Trek Discovery, which is the name of his new show, has to be the most progressive show of all time. I think if anyone's going to watch a Star Trek show or if it's going to make waves and actually get people talking about it, it's going to have to go to like some crazy degree. You know, what Gene Roddenberry did in that original series, really like mad relationships, gender, identity, sexuality, just all across the board, whatever they're going to find in space, it's going to be nuts. And this panel totally got me on board. Like, I think it could be really crazy.
Well, I think for those of you who don't know, Brian Fuller, who is best known for like Pushing Daisies and Dead Like Me Wonderfalls and Hannibal, of course, and is doing American Gods and then is doing Star Trek. He got his start on Star Trek. It was Voyager was his like show that he wrote on. That's where he started. So he has like these deep roots in the Star Trek universe. He's such a thoughtful writer. I talked to him later that night at a party and like asked him about the panel and he was like, I was so overcome with everything I don't remember except that dumb, like, racy joke that I made, which went over really well with the audiences. But it was a weird panel because it was in the middle of the day between the big Warner Brothers panel in the beginning of the day and the big Marvel panel at the end of the day. So Hall H was just filled with people who were biding their time because they slept out overnight to get in there and they weren't leaving until they saw Marvel's big show. So like the Star Trek panel, because it didn't have anything like enormous to sell except for the unveiling of the ship, was maybe a time when people were kind of checked out mentally and recouping. I was on the edge of my seat because I like I'm a big Star Trek fan, but like the people who were there who just like want to come to Comic-Con for the big splashy shows, like maybe that's why you weren't hearing an audience that was engaged as they might otherwise be. But I just thought Brian Fuller, who's my favorite quote that he said, was something about how like, oh, we need to put some height in our freak flag, which is a way to say like let your freak flag fly. Like he said, we all need to put some height in our freak flag. And I admire him so much. I'm so happy that like even though his shows keep getting canceled, people keep hiring him to do interesting things. And I can't think of anyone better. I'm a little worried about this whole like CBS All Access platform.
No.
I'm not.
This is gonna be
definitely buy in.
Okay.
This is going to do to streaming what Next Generation did to syndication for our shows.
I hope
you're
right.
It's going to be on Netflix everywhere besides North America immediately. And like whether or not people are buying into CBS All Access, Star Trek is worldwide and Netflix
is huge. When I move to Canada in November, I'll be ready, hooked up to watch.
Nope, still not Star Canada. Trek. Nope. Oh, you have to go of North America.
Oh, no.
Otherwise, you have to buy into CBS. They got you.
Yeah, I think it sounds amazing, and I hope it has even an ounce of the energy that Fuller gives in that panel. So that was really encouraging. See, Comic-Con can be very positive and not all crass commercialism.
Until next year.
Let me just say really quickly. The American Gods panel was the same way, where it was all about like love and connectivity and all this stuff. And like, I just think that Brian Fuller is, you know, the leader we need right now.
Then why wasn't Hannibal good? Huh?
Oh,
riddle
my
me
God.
This.
Hannibal was amazing.
Oh, God. Huh? Oh, no. Oh, no.
You're
oh,
the
no.
worst. All of you. Watch BoJack. Let's move on.
That's it for this week's episode of Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week, because we're actually not going to do a review this week. Jason Bourne
is very... Am I the only... Joanna, Dave, have you seen Bourne?
I had to miss Bourne. No. Scheduling. So, sorry, David.
I regret to inform you, as somebody who really, really enjoyed the Bourne Ultimatum, which is the last Paul Greengrass Bourne movie, that this is awful. It is all of the worst attributes of a Bourne movie. It has no reason to exist. The action is completely incomprehensible in a way where the Bourne Ultimatum found some grace. It's yet another, and this is really the only interesting element of it, is that it's becoming clearer and clearer that the conversation about privacy in the digital era is becoming the overwhelming, overarching theme of all action
movies.
There
are Russians. We're going to get you, privacy.
Yeah.
It seems so easy. For some reason, like you're dodging actual issues. But
the Russians were easy.
Riz Ahmed is the from the Night of is the guy in this one. He's the Mark Zuckerberg like
Riz Ahmed
security guy. Yeah, this is a really really bad movie, which is upsetting because I thought it was going to be one of the great hopes for blockbuster cinema this summer. It's one of the worst. It's not like Warcraft or anything, or Independence Day 4, but watching how they... Independence Day 2, sorry. Watching the video of how they shot, like, the climactic car chase, for example, which you can see on YouTube, is so much more amazing and entertaining and impressive than what the actual footage looks like. So rather than spend all your money and go to the theater and see Bourne, which I promise you will not, even if you're like a diehard Bourne fan, has nothing to offer you, go on YouTube and watch the behind-the-scenes stuff. It's really incredible.
There you go. But there will be a new storm of spoilers, right?
Yes. Star Trek, we're beaming. But actually, that's not my plug. Yes, there will be a new storm of spoilers tomorrow.
You're beaming.
Beaming. Places everywhere.
So why don't we tell people where they can find us and wrap this show up?
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name DA70, which is also my Twitter handle. You can find my writing at latino-review.com and geek.com. You can also find all my podcasts and the rest of the episodes of this fantastic show that you heard so positively reviewed at the top of this episode at fightinginthewarroom.com.
Oh, I'm Joanna Robinson, right? Is it my turn? Sorry.
It can be your turn.
No, it's Dave. It's David's turn. Sorry.
I'm David Ehrlich. I am particularly noxious this week because it is so hot. Oh, so hot. And this election, I think, is slowly breaking me. Or not so slowly. Anyway, apologies for the vitriol. You can find me in more measured terms on IndieWire, where I am the senior film critic, writing about not Jason Bourne, but writing about Nerve, which is a movie that you may not have heard of, with Dave Franco and Emma Roberts by the Catfish Guys, which comes out on Wednesday, I think, which I quite liked. And you can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
Hey, I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where you can read all my Comic-Con coverage. You can follow me at Joe Wrote This on Twitter now that I am done tweeting about Comic-Con. And if you want to hear us talk about Comic-Con, we will be doing so on Storm of Spoilers, as well as talking about Star Trek.
And I am Matt Patches. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. I am the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. You should go there and read stuff. Redesign the site. Looks nice. And you should answer our lightning round question this week, which is...
In honor of Bad Moms, what's the funniest female performance of the pre-2000s?
And because we're not doing a review episode, answer on Twitter and we will retweet you. It's at FITWR. Until next week, bye-bye.